So the topic for this morning is, as you see on your sheets, what is Yiras Hashem? Of fear, awe, and loyalty. And this is a topic which I've been wanting to deal with for a very long time. It is, for me, my last great question on the book of Iyov. Some of you know, some of you were here. I taught Iyov for 2 years here in this room. In the course of, 70-something classes about it, we looked at it from different angles. We went verse by verse, asked a lot of questions, and for most of them, I think that I've come up with sort of an approach that I understand and that fits. But the last big question that I've been stuck with is that Job appears to be loyal to Hashem the entire time. Despite the fact that he rages at God, he wants to bring God into court for his suffering and so forth, and we'll talk about his story a little bit. Nonetheless, he is considered loyal to God. Hashem calls him at the end, Avdi, my servant. And what I don't understand is sort of a hybrid of two questions. Number one, how could he be called loyal to God? How could he be called the servant of God after railing at God for 42 chapters, 41? And number two is, if he is still Yirei Elokim, as he's described, God-fearing, or God-awing, or God-revering, why? Given everything that he experiences, how is it that he continues to maintain this status? And those are the two questions that drove me to this topic. But it particularly relates to Rosh Hashanah. Because on Rosh Hashanah, we emphasize Yiras Hashem. We emphasize reverence, awe, fear of God. We talk about recognizing Hashem as King. We talk about Rosh Hashanah as Yom Hadin, the Day of Judgment. And that's something in and of itself that I think is problematic in our day. Because in an era where we've seen the horrors of the Holocaust, and in an era when we've seen science argue that it can disprove and debunk and rationalize and explain all of the events of our lives, when traditional feelings of certainty regarding Hashem and Hashem's conduct are very hard to muster, to say, well, I know Hashem is doing this, is Yirah still possible? Is it possible to have a feeling of Yiras Hashem? And again, I keep translating Yiras Hashem in different ways because it means different things to different people. Yiras Hashem is not a simple phrase to translate. And that's what I wanted to show you in source number one. Source number one comes from the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. If you're familiar with, when people quote Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, this is his great-grandfather, the father of Rabbi Chaim Brisker, and major piece of the whole Brisker line, in which he gives us three different presentations of what Yirah is in relation to Hashem, none of which are the ones that we're going to end up with. But it's important to see his presentation first. He says in the Hebrew, Yeshnei Ofanei Yirah. He says there are two kinds of Yirah. He's going to end up with three, don't worry. But he starts out by saying there are two kinds of Yirah. In the interest of time, I'm going to read out of the English, but I want you to have the Hebrew so you can see that as well, to see the original. He says there are two kinds of Yirah. And again, Yirah, most literally translated, generally means fear. And so that's our starting point. He says, one is fear of punishment. Yiras ha'onesh. If a person contemplates his past non-good deeds, and I use that because that's his phrase. He says, ma'asav asher lo tovim. If a person contemplates what he has done in the past that has not been good, and the magnitude of the punishment which will reach him because of those deeds, he will be filled... No, can you just help with the door? Thanks. He will be filled with fear and terror. The first kind of Yirah, the first kind of, again, fear, awe, reverence, whatever term you want to employ, but I'm using fear as the most literal translation of Yirah, is for a person to say, I've done terrible things and punishment is waiting for me. That's the first approach to it. And lest one think that that's a cheap form of Yirah, just, I'm afraid of getting zapped. That, what kind of relationship with Hashem is that? The truth is that the Rambam, in his Sefer HaMitzvos, his book of Mitzvos, his fourth Aseh. His fourth commandment is that a person should have Yirah, and he describes it as Yirah's Ha'onesh. That's his description. Fear of being punished. That's the Rambam's definition of the mitzvah of Yirat Hashem, is to be afraid of being zapped. That's his approach. But then the Beis Halevi continues, and he says, there's a second kind. In truth, there is another kind. When faith in the aforementioned ideas he discussed before getting to this point, is established in his heart, that God perpetually creates the world from nothing, and that if he would not create it for an instant, then it would all be emptiness. When a person contemplates that, then fear and terror will befall him. It is like a person who falls into the sea, and another comes and grabs his hand, keeping him from drowning. If that person would relent in gripping him, would he not drown? Then he will love the one who grips him and fear from him simultaneously. You follow? The second model of Yirah is an awareness of what Hashem does for us, and as a result of that, a sense of love on one level, like, wow, look at everything God does for me, and a sense of fear of, imagine if God would stop doing this for me. That's the second type of Yirah that's outlined. He says, regarding this Yirah, we are promised all Israel will achieve it in the future in the time of Mashiach. For in our current state, this cannot be achieved with human senses, he says. You can't really know what Hashem does for you. It is currently only faith. And when one is distracted from it for an instant, it's forgotten from the heart. That's the second kind. I don't want to put anybody on the spot by asking how many of us feel the first kind and how many of us feel the second kind. But the truth of the matter is that it's hard to really feel the second kind, to recognize what Hashem does for us. Yes?
But the second kind you say every morning when you say what Olam Yehei Adam Kedesh
Shamayim. Yes?
And I think that's the most beautiful part of Shabbos. It's my personal feeling. But it encompasses that whole second union that you're saying.
Yes. It's absolutely part of our davening.
But then it's part of our, in the morning, it's part of how we start our day.
But my question would be,
how do you forget it then?
Well, my question isn't how do we forget it. My question is, you know, while saying words, are we necessarily able to feel it? And I think that your mileage may vary. I think that for some people it will be easier than for others. And I think as the Beis Halevi actually states, and there's more than I brought here. I skipped some in the interest of fitting everything on one page. Those who have been in my classes before know that I love the idea of fitting everything on one page. The trees thank me for it. But the Beis Halevi goes on to say that often somebody will achieve this for a moment, but then they'll fall out of it. And maybe they can achieve it while they're saying it, but it's very hard to live life at this level. He describes it as something that people will experience in the time of Mashiach. They will have a greater consciousness of Hashem, and at that point they'll really be able to experience this. But it's a very hard thing. And I'm glad to know that there are people who can achieve it more. I find it challenging. I don't think it's straightforward. But those are two kinds, and then he says there's a third. He says, V'yeshod ofen shlishi, even though he began by saying there were two kinds of yira, we'll forgive him the math. He says, there is a third kind, which is yira'ah of Hashem's greatness, what he calls in Hebrew, yira'as haromimus. Romimus, like being rum v'nisa, being elevated, being lofty, a yira'ah of God's greatness. I didn't want to use the word fear because it's not really fear at this stage. When one contemplates God's greatness, then fear, I did end up using fear actually, then fear befalls him. Meaning, a sense of just how wonderful Hashem is, just how great Hashem is, all the power that is at his disposal, and that causes yirah. So the Beis Halevi gives us three kinds of yirah. Fear of punishment, recognition of how much we rely on God, and a sense of God's greatness. But again, I come back to what I said in the beginning, which is, I think it's really hard in our era to live up to any of these. Whether because of the promises of science to explain things, or because of what we've seen in our lives, lives of parents and grandparents, in terms of what happened in the Shoah, it's really hard to say Hashem is, let's say, going to punish me for wrongdoing. When we look around and we see people who aren't punished for apparent wrongdoing, we see people who were wonderful and suffered horribly, right? You don't need the Shoah as an example. There are others, but that's just, you know, the most blatant one. The idea of, you know, recognizing all the things that Hashem does for us and makes for us. You know, I'm university educated and I study the sciences and I know all the claims about how the world works and came to exist and so on. It becomes harder to sense and feel this. Even if I understand and I'm committed and I believe this as a level of emuna, to feel it as a sense inside, to really have a sense of awe and a sense of reverence and a sense of fear, can be challenging. Am I just talking about my own challenges? And does that resonate for anybody here? Yes, honey.
I think that there's, I'm talking about me and myself, but our feelings are more like you are the ahava.
Yeah.
That would be much easier for us, like, you know, when we see punishment, then we fear. But, you know, on an easier basis, we're happy and something good happens is the ahava.
Right.
And then I would say sometimes, like, your ahava would be if, like, let's say, we go to a place or something in nature and we stand near a volcano but we're nothing happened to us, then we could feel the greatness of Yirat HaRamamut.
Right. There are certainly experiences that can help a person get to that stage. I would definitely agree with you on that. And, you know, that's actually worthy, I think, of its own shiur in terms of, so how do you get to the three that the Beis Halevi is talking about. But what I want to present, as I said at the outset, is actually a different model. Not one of the three, but equally found within our Masorah, within our tradition, and I think in many ways more accessible than some of the others, if only as a starting, as a stepping stone for a person. And here I wanted to talk about the story of Iyov. In a nutshell, because, you know, it's 42 chapters and we've got 20 minutes or 25 minutes. But the story begins with a question. Not, as people often think, a question about God, but rather a question about human beings. Sefer Iyov at its core is the trial of humanity, in which the question is asked, are we loyal to Hashem, or are we loyal to our own perceived best interests, that which we think is going to be fundamentally good for us? Iyov is introduced with four great descriptions. He is Tam. Tam means what?
Simple.
Without defect. Pure, simple in the sense that there's no flaw, there's no variation within him. He is described as Tam. Not Tam of the Seder, that's a different Tam. Yashar, he's described as being righteous, which we understand to mean Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, the way you deal with other people. Yirei Elokim, he is Yirei Elokim, which is this term we have to define, loosely rendered often as God-fearing, but we need to do more with it. And Sar Meira, he stays away from performing evil. And Hashem identifies Iyov as the best on the planet. There is nobody better than Iyov. The whole world, all the human beings, whoever you can name, whoever you can mention from his generation, whenever his generation was, which is part of the problem, but there is nobody better than Iyov on the planet. I should probably take the opportunity to note that in the Gemara there is a view, which the Rambam believes is the correct view, that he never existed and the whole story never happened, and it's a mashal, it's a parable. No human beings, no Iyovs were harmed in the making of this book. That said, it's one view within the Gemara. There are other views in the Gemara that try to pinpoint when he lived, who he was he Jewish or not Jewish, and so on. It's not a simple question. But the Satan challenges Hashem. Hashem has a gathering of the Malachim. The Satan crashes the party. He's not invited. But he barges in, and he says, you know, I've been all over the planet, and for me, business is good. Wherever I go, I am accepted with open arms. And my job is finding fault with people. My job is showing people's weaknesses, and I can do that wherever I go. And Hashem says, there is somebody who proves you wrong. And his name is Iyov. And God describes all of his wonderful traits and says he's the best on the planet. And the Satan says, really? But he only says really about one trait. He doesn't deny that Iyov can be without defect. He doesn't deny that Iyov can be yashar, righteous with others. He doesn't deny that Iyov stays away from evil. He denies Yirei Elokim. He says, he's not really Yirei Elokim. He's only Yirei Elokim because you give him everything he wants. Take it away from him. Then see how he does. That's the challenge that Satan gives. Now you'll ask the question that people always ask about this book. Why in the world does God take Satan up on the wager? To which my answer as I read the Sefer is because it's not Eov who's on the line, and it's not God's pride that's on the line, it's humanity that's on the line. The book is the trial of humanity. Just like if you think back to the story of the Mabul, of the flood. The world has been judged and found to be lacking, and Hashem is going to wipe it out because they don't have the merit. That's what the Satan is alleging. It's time to wipe out humanity. The system doesn't work. Human beings cannot live up to divine expectations. Every time you reward them, it just makes them worse. And so what Hashem is doing is he's saying, no, I'm choosing Eov as the champion of humanity. If Eov wins, human beings survive. If Eov loses, then who needs humanity? There are major stakes here in what happens with Eov. There's more to discuss about it and about what's going on with him. You know, that's not a surprise. But this is what happens, and so Eov goes on trial, so to speak. In source number 2, the pasuk at the end of that source, the verse at the end of the source, I've already told you about the first parts of it. And Hashem said to the Satan, "Behold, all that he owns is in your hand, but do not send forth your hand against him. Just don't hurt him. Everything else you can take." Satan interprets that very broadly. All of Eov's property is gone. And Eov's family is gone. His wife remains, but his children, as far as Eov knows, are all dead. Not so clear. When you read chapter 42, it looks like they were alive and just hidden somewhere. The commentators discuss that. But as far as Eov knows, they're all gone. But he himself is physically safe. At this point, Eov has been transported to a parallel universe. It's a world that Hashem does not control. Right? Think about it. This is now a case in which a human being is being hurt, and without any question, without any doubt, he has done nothing wrong. This bothers the commentators so much that some of them go hunting for anything you could say about Eov to try to show, well, maybe in some way he deserved it. Maybe when he said this, he should have done that. He was God-fearing. He didn't love God. But you already have your answer in the book when Hashem says there is nobody as good as Eov. I defy anybody in this room and all of their siblings and cousins and rabbis and friends and anybody you've ever known to earn the title of number one on earth. You can't cheapen that. You can't take that away from him and say, well, he did not deserve punishment. I'm sorry. He has been taken out of the realm of what we think of as the Torah's view of human existence into a world in which a person can be hit and have done nothing wrong. But he doesn't know it. And his visitors don't know it either. They don't know this is all a game. They think this is life. And so, Eov suffers. He initially responds by saying, look, God gave me everything I have. It was his right to take it away. Then he gets hurt physically. He's struck with boils. And still, as the text says, he does not challenge Hashem. And then he gets 3 visitors, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sophar. And we're not going to go through all of their conversations. That's the first half of the book, pretty much, and then some. But in round 1, they have a dialogue. So Eliphaz tries to tell Eov that everything God does is just. You must have done something wrong. Turn to God, pray to him, and all will be good. And Eov rebuts what Eliphaz has to say. And then along comes Bildad. And Bildad says to him, you know, sometimes something looks bad, but it turns out to be good. And he just wants to slap him. I mean, he's like, what are you talking about? And he yells at Bildad also. And then Sophar comes and he says, you know, Hashem judges for things you can't even see. And one of the commentators suggests that what Sophar is trying to say is maybe Hashem is judging you based on your potential. Because as great as you are, you could have been even better. And that's what Hashem is punishing you for not living up to how good you could have been. And Eov has no patience for that either. So then they go another round, with each of them speaking in turn. And then they go a third round. Eliphaz speaks, Eov responds, Bildad speaks, Eov responds, and then they're done. Then Eov gives closing speeches. He talks about the meaninglessness of trying to debate and figure out how the world works in this conversation. He summarizes his experiences. He's visited by somebody else by the name of Elihu, who seems to have been sitting there the whole time, but was silent the entire time. Elihu insists that Hashem communicates with human beings. Hashem is benevolent. His deeds are perfect. And then finally, Hashem speaks. Not to Elihu, but to Eov. And he says to Eob, there can be no communication between us. It's just the way it works. Your world and my world are entirely different. I function on a plane and deal with things that you do not deal with. And again, read the book. There's so much more to say. Eob turns to Hashem, or listen to 70-something Shirim. They're all on yutorah.org. But at the end, Eob apologizes. He acknowledges his ignorance. He says, you know, I spoke without really understanding what I was talking about. And Hashem at that point turns to the visitors and says, you guys got it all wrong. All those things you were saying to defend me, you have no idea of the way the world works. You should apologize to Eob. Because if you don't, I'm going to hit you, he says to them. And they apologize to Eob. Eob davens on their behalf. And Hashem then restores, apparently, wealth and family to Eob. And that's the end of the book. But here are my questions about the narrative that we're going to have to deal with. Number one. Go back to the game in the beginning. Go back to Satan's wager. He says, Eob is not really Yirei Elokim. He doesn't really fear you. What is it that he wants to do in order to test whether Eob really fears God? What is it that he wants to do? To hit him, right? That's what he says. Does that make sense? In the context of Satan's own logic, does that make sense? How is hitting him gonna make him fear God less? Yeah, it'll make him fear more. Hold on. It's gonna make him fear. In other words, if you're talking about somebody who lives with the Beis HaLevi's first approach, right? Yiras HaOnesh, afraid of getting hit. So now what's gonna happen? You're gonna hit him, and now he's gonna be less afraid? You're gonna prove now that he's not really afraid? The logic doesn't make any sense. And if you're going to tell me that it's the second kind, that what we're talking about is afraid, what would happen to me if Hashem would let go? Again, hitting him doesn't cause him to be less afraid of God letting go. And if it's Yiras Haromimus, awe for this great God, well, then I don't understand at all. Then you're telling me you're going to test him by giving him a false impression of God. Like, what's going on? What does this mean? Shana, are you going to say?
That it seems that Yirat Elohim here means gratitude. And if you stop getting the things that you're being grateful for, then you stop being grateful.
So is Yirat Elohim gratitude? So the Satan's vision of it, I think, is more or less gratitude. And not in the sense of a good gratitude, in a negative gratitude. Like, God paid me, therefore I'm going to keep showing up to work. Not gratitude like, God did wonderful things, and therefore I have warm feelings for him. Sorry?
More bribe-like.
Yes, more bribe-like, I think. I think that's a fair statement. That's my first problem, is how does the test make sense? And then my second problem is that, as I said in the beginning, the book seems to say that Eob passed the test. There are sources that say he did not. There's a Rashi that seems to say he didn't. There's an Itzil who seems to say he didn't. But basically, Hashem calls him Avdi, my servant, at the end of the book. How many people in Tanakh become known as Avdi, Hashem's servant? It's a very short list. Moshe, David. It's not a long list by any stretch of the imagination. If he can rank as Avdi, I think he passed the test. And so my question is, he spends the book railing against God. He calls Hashem his enemy at one point. He says, Hashem has harmed me unjustly. I want to bring God to trial. How in the world does he pass the test of being Yirei Elokim if he can say these things about God?
Because you're acknowledging that it's coming from him.
Acknowledging that it comes from him. So then what's my definition of Yirei Elokim?
Like, I know, like in the Holocaust, you know, so many people just threw away Yiddishkeit, mm-hmm. but some were angry, and that's also a level of a relationship because you're acknowledging that there is a relationship. You can only be angry at someone who you have a relationship.
Right. If he doesn't exist, what's the point of being angry? And I would agree with that. But I still, I think that supports the idea that there's a relationship. But Yirah, is that a relationship of Yirah at that point, or is it, you know, an enmity, really? You know, he exists, and boy, am I angry at him. I'm not sure how I would fit that with Yirah. Yeah.
Does anybody look at Yirah and look at coming from the Ra, seeing God?
Interesting. So, from a pure etymological standpoint, they're different words. Having said that, we have all sorts of figures, you know, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch being the most famous, who try to break down three-letter roots into two-letter roots, and to show that there are commonalities between words that we might have thought were not associated. And that works on many occasions. So could you argue that it's about a sense of Hashem, rather than awe, reverence per se? I think it's an interesting idea. Probably one worth pursuing. But not the one I'm going to pursue for the next 10 minutes. Okay. So what I want to float is the following. We need to talk about Eov's view of Hashem, and I think it's going to come back a little bit into the relationship issue, and I think a little bit into some of the other things that have been said. Let's see if this makes sense. Eov's view of Hashem. Eov's conception of Hashem's actions is fundamentally conflicted. It starts with the way Hashem treats him personally. Eov clearly believes, he says outright, that God has warped his judgment. That God has warped the judgment meted out to Eov. And yet he simultaneously identifies Hashem as his king and the source of his hope. Take a look, please, at source number 3. I love this sentence. Perikov Zayin. This is the end of the debate between Eov and the visitors, and he's giving his closing arguments and his summaries. Chay Kel Heisir Mishpati Vishakai Heimar Nafshi. Chay Kel. What is that expression? Chay Kel? It's an oath. By the life of God, who do you swear by? When you swear by somebody, who do you swear by? The king. Right? When somebody swears by the life of, it's by the life of the king that they swear. Chai Kel, he's declaring Hashem as his king. Hey, Sir Mishpati, who has warped my justice. But I still consider him the king. Source number 4, classic one. The word that's in the carrots in the middle is the ketiv, the way that it's written. If you were to look at an Eov in an original cloth, it will be written with an aleph, but we're told that we're supposed to read it with a vav, which changes the meaning of the word. Hein yikteleni lo ayachil. Though he will kill me, I will trust in him. What in the world is that about? It's a magnificent pasuk. I first came across it in a poem by Ibn Gibirol, where he talks about it. He talks about running away from Hashem towards Hashem. The magnificence of the sentiment, where he can say that even though he's going to kill me, nonetheless, I am still going to run to him. I am still going to long for him. He still has this sense of closeness to Hashem. It's a very difficult line to understand, and we're going to have to come back to it. Take a look at the next source, in which Eov describes Hashem. Apo taraf vayistameni, his rage, his af, struck, and he hated me. Charak alai b'shinav, he ground his teeth upon me. Tsari, my enemy, capital E, yiltosh einav li, flashes his eyes upon me like in wrath. That's a description of Hashem as an enemy. Flip the page, please. Source number 6. Just a couple of chapters later. Vani yadati goali chai, and I know that my Redeemer lives. Ve'acharon alafar yakum, he will stand last upon the soil. Now, you have to know, if you ever read Eov, then you know this. Every pasuk in Eov lends itself to multiple explanations. You read Rashi, you get one. Radak, you get another one. Rabak, you get another one. Mitzvah David, maybe a little bit of Rabak in there. The Malbim will give you yet another layer. So each of the pasukim that I'm giving you, you should know. You can find a commentator who will say something different to explain the line and try to get rid of some of the incredible contradictions we see. But I don't think the point is to explain the contradictions. I think the contradictions are meant. And yes, he can call Hashem his enemy, and in the next speech, he can call Hashem his redeemer, and the two go side by side. He is conflicted in terms of his own experience, and he's conflicted in terms of the way Hashem deals with the world. Take a look, please, at source number 7. He asks the global question, the theme of the second round of speeches altogether in the Sefer. Madua Rashaim Yichyu, he says, why do the wicked live? They become tough, they grow in strength. Their seed, meaning their children, is established before them, with them, in front of them, with them, they get to enjoy seeing them, and their descendants before their eyes. He says, the wicked thrive. But on the other hand, in source number 9, number 8, excuse me, he speaks of the wicked suffering. Hatzakaso Yishmakel, he says, is God going to hear his cry, the cry of the wicked? When trouble befalls him, Hashem is not interested in him. Hashem is not going to save him. He's conflicted because in his experience he also sees that there are wicked people who thrive, and then on the other end, sometimes Hashem abandons the wicked. I'm going to take a moment just to ask again that the sheets with the sign and information please make it around. Where are they right now? They are where? Right there. Okay, so if anyone didn't get to, please make sure at some point to, perhaps in the gap between the two classes. Eov is conflicted, and so one of his major complaints throughout the Sefer is what you see in source number 9. He wants Hashem to speak to him. And that's really what he wants most of all, and it's what he gets in the end. He wants God to communicate. Explain what's going on. You know, you want to do this? You have a reason for it? Just tell me. And so you take a look at source number 9. He says, in Karasi, if I were to call out, Vayanini, and Hashem would answer me, Lo a'amin ki yazin koli, I couldn't believe it, that he had listened to my voice. Like, wow, that would be it for me. He uses the same expression of Lo a'amin later in the Sefer to describe, or is Hashem speaking at that point, to describe the way a horse responds to the battle cry in war. I can't believe it's luck. Now I get to go to war. That's what he describes himself. Like, if only Hashem would speak to me, that will be it. That will be the source of my greatest joy. There's only one thing that Eov is really clear on. And this, to me, is the key. He's clear that he believes that Hashem is on the side of justice. That's something that is very important to Eov. However justice works, God is on the side of justice. Take a look at source number 10, please. He says, he's speaking to the visitors. He says to the visitors, you know, you have this description of God. It doesn't match. It's wrong. And you think that you are justifying God, but what you're doing is lying about God. He says, will you speak wickedly for God and speak deceitfully for him? Will you gain his favor? Will you fight for God? Will it be good should he seek you? Or as one man deceives another, will you deceive him? He will surely rebuke you. He says, you should know there's punishment coming. If you are going to speak this way about God, you think you're defending God and justifying all he does and he has a reason and everything else. You're lying about Hashem, he says. And it's not going to be good for you. And he's right, because that's exactly what happens in chapter 42. Hashem comes to them and says, what you've said about me is wrong. So, you know, he's right when he says this. He says, don't try to justify it. Hashem has no patience for flattery. And Hashem knows that I am righteous. And that's in source number 11. He says, Hashem knows my way. He has tested me. I emerge like gold. And only Eov can say that. In his path, my foot has set out. I have guarded his path. I will not stray. The command of his lips, I will not stray. In my path, I have guarded the words of his mouth. I have done that which God expected of me, and God knows it. And Eov values that. And this is where I get to what I think is a potential answer for what's going on in Eov, and more broadly, a fourth model of Yiras Hashem, or Yiras Elohim, as Eov would probably put it. For Eov, Yirah is not awe. Yirah is loyalty, in Eov's mind. Eov believes that Hashem is on the side of justice. He doesn't understand how in the world this justice plays out. He doesn't see this justice play out. What he has seen, in fact, is the antithesis of justice. What he's seeing is injustice and pain and something that he did not deserve and that people around him did not deserve. But in his mind, there is a recognition that God is just, and he will have awe for, and he will revere that justice that he doesn't see play out, that he doesn't experience in his own life. And because of that, he says, I am going to continue to act in a just way. Take a look at source number 12. He says, as long as my soul is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, he says, if my lips will speak corruption, if my tongue would express cunning, my righteous path I maintain, and I will not release it. My heart will never be put to shame. He says, I continue to serve Hashem because I believe that God is just. I don't see it in his actions. I don't understand where it is in this world, but that is my belief. And that's what he—that's what he holds to, and he says it straight out. The Eliphaz actually says it straight out in source number 13. This is Eliphaz, the first of the visitors to speak, talking to Iyov. He says, "Halo yirascha kislasecha, is your yirah not your strength? That is the source of your strength. That is what you've been hoping in, tikvatcha. And that is tom drachecha. That's what drives your purity. It's because you have this loyalty to Hashem. That's what drives you. That's what makes you do the things you do. Not your experience of God, but your vision of God." If you take a look at source number 14, and we're getting towards the end of the time here, we started a few minutes late because of the setup issues. I apologize. But take a look at source number 14. Rabbi Menachem Meiri, commenting on Mishle. If you've never read the Meiri on Mishle, I highly recommend it. The Meiri comments here, and again, I'm going to go with the English in the interest of time. He says, Yirat Hashem is specifically applied to fulfilling a matter which one's mind does not push him to fulfill. In other words, doing a mitzvah, doing something that is right, even though your mind doesn't comprehend it. He fulfills it, the person who has yirah fulfills it because of yirah of the one who commanded it. Even though analysis doesn't mandate it, and may even stand opposite in an ambush, rising against it, when you apply your mind, you say, no, that's not what I should be doing, I should be doing something else. That's what we call a chok, usually. A law that you don't understand, and even that may be antithetical to your understanding. This includes, he says, belief in creation. He's writing this in the 14th century, by the way. Belief in creation, changing nature with miracles, divine supervision, reward and punishment, and all those other mitzvot, those of revelation as opposed to logic. Shofar, lulav, not wearing shatnez, not eating treif. All of these, he says, are fulfilled due to yirah. Your mind won't necessarily accept it. But it's a vision that we have. A vision of a God who is awe-worthy. That's what we're talking about. It's not the three models of the Beis Halevi in the beginning. It's a different model. I came up with the following formulation, which I think is correct. It's not an awe inspired by certainty about God. It's a loyalty which defies uncertainty about God. And the opposition I would put before you is that Avraham believes God, Iyov believes in God. In the sense that Avraham has communication from Hashem, right? From the beginning, from Lech Lecha. Hashem says, go, right? Sarah is the one who has the real challenge because she doesn't get the message from Hashem. She's getting it through the Navi, through Avraham. But Avraham, Hashem tells him, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that, take up your son. Avraham's greatness is that he believes that voice that he's hearing and does all these things that are demanded, which, you know, defy human behavior. Avraham believes God. Iyov believes in God. Because he does all this until chapter 40, well, basically the last three chapters of the book, without any communication whatsoever. He's sticking to all this without ever having heard a word from Hashem. That's the greatness that he has. It's his remarkable loyalty. And that's why Satan's test is to harm him. Because he wants to see, can I push him out of being loyal? Let's see whether he'll be loyal once he's suffering extreme pain.
Could you repeat the statement you made? Part of it says, a loyalty that defies.
It defies uncertainty about God.
A loyalty that defies uncertainty.
Uncertainty about God, yeah.
What you said previously to that.
It's not awe inspired by certainty about God, but loyalty which defies uncertainty about God. And that's how Iyov passes the test. Even as he rails against God, he rails, but he insists all along that he is still loyal. He says it in the book. He calls Hashem his Redeemer. Even as he is upset, he's offended at the violation of the God he believes in. That's what offends him and upsets him. That Hashem could allow this to happen or even engineer it to happen. No, that's not who you are. That's not what you are. That's not what I've always thought you to be. And what I continue to think you to be. And I just don't understand the conflict between real world experience and what I'm envisioning. And as I said at the outset, I think we live in a world in which the Beis Halevi's three types of yira, you know, fear that one is going to get punished, fear that God is going to let go and no longer help, or awe of God's greatness, I think those are difficult. Certainty about Hashem is very challenging. And as the Beis Halevi says, people may achieve it for some period of time. You experience a special mood, a special moment, but then it's very hard to capture that again. But I think perhaps we can work towards Eov's Yira, belief in the Torah's description of a just God, because we do see elements of it at times. We may not perceive it all the time, but there are times when we do see it. And I think that's something that works well, in my mind, with the Sefer, with the book, and my own experience. It means that you can express the doubts and express the frustration. It's a good idea to first be as great as Eov was before doing that. But to express the doubt and the frustration, as well as absorbing the humility that comes at the end of Eov. Right? Where Eov says, I apologize, I didn't know what I was talking about. You can't read the book without the ending. Right? That's a key part of it too. But embracing the Torah's vision of Hashem, that vision of a God who is, you know, this just God, and committing ourselves to that vision. I'm going to take one question, but then I have to yield so that people can take refreshments, and then the second class can begin. Robertson Vale.
I just wonder, how is this a different description than just plain emunah? I mean, emunah is loyalty. It's loyalty to...
Right. I don't think it is different. I don't think it's all that different. When I was going through, thinking this through in the first place, I actually wasn't sure even that what I was describing was Yira until I found the Meiri. And I felt like, oh, I have a source. Okay, the Meiri's on my side. But otherwise, I think you're right. I think fundamentally, it's certainly Emunah-driven. Because it's not experience-driven. It's Emunah-driven. It's the translation of Emunah, taking Emunah into that phase of, what does this mean for me? How does this change my perspective towards Hashem? But fundamentally, I would tend to think that it is fundamentally Emunah-driven. I will say, as I like to say at various classes, my email address is always at the top of the sheet. I'm glad to continue the conversation by email afterwards. I'll also stick around for a couple of minutes until the next class starts. Thank you so much. It's great to see people from different parts of the city all coming together to learn before Yom Tov. I hope it was worth the schlep. If it wasn't, that's okay, because there's another class coming with Mrs. Ziering, who's going to be speaking about why we fast on Yom Kippur. Thank you.